And we're away. Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, and I hope my talks resemble what you just described. It's a very intimidating room. I might as well tell you that right off the bat. So if I look like I'm cowering in fear up here, I am. I think I'm probably within easy range projectiles from every seat in the house. The brochure promised two talks today. Does this work? Yeah. No. Yeah. Okay, good. Two talks today. The one talk is what is quality in e-learning? And that's the talk that we're supposed to do before we have our break. And then the second talk is who is the new student? And then the two talks are roughly as outlined. At least that was how the plan went. Now, I always am faced with a bit of a dilemma when I do a talk, and this is no exception. And the dilemma is the pull between what it is that people want to hear and what it is that I want to say. And they're not always the same thing. And as always, I go with what it is I want to say, hope that I have sufficient lead time to get out of the room before anyone can get out of their seats. So what I've done is I'm going to actually throw away this scheme, and I'm going to talk about these two topics, and we are going to have a break. That's very, very important. What I've decided to do is to try to mix and match and combine the two topics into one. Because if you think about it, the topic of quality cannot be addressed without looking at the topic of the new student. And if you also think about it, the topic of the new student cannot be addressed without thinking about that in terms of quality. So, it didn't make sense to talk about quality and to come in and do the usual, okay, here's what we need for a good course, right? We need interaction, we need short paragraphs, and so on and so forth. This is the list. I'm sure everybody's seen the list. And it didn't make sense either to come in and just say, okay, well, now today's new students have short attention spans and so on. You can always spot them. They're the ones leaving the room. That didn't make sense either. So I'm going to kind of work these two themes back and forth as we go through. In the spirit of the new student as well, I'm not really going to do a linear, let's start here and go to the end. Now, of course, I am using PowerPoint, so I am in a certain sense constrained. If I was brave, I would emulate Brian Lamb, put up a wiki on the board, and just riff on whatever he happens to click on. I'm not as brave as Brian Lamb. So, although it may appear that there's a linear progression of slides, I will bounce from theme to theme. Those of you who have read my newsletter or visited my website probably expected something like this. And as for the rest of you, well, I do hope it's a useful and valuable experience. And with that, I'll throw in my usual start of the talk caveat. If it's not, tell me. I reserve the right at any time to completely abandon my plan and to talk about what you want to talk about. So if you want to, if you have questions or some comments, brickbats, whatever, during the course of my talk, by all means, pitch in with them. We do have a schedule. In my mind, schedules are theoretical constructs that can be adjusted to match whatever it is that were happening. Now, I know you didn't want me to say that, but now, because it's difficult, especially once I get going, it's difficult to interrupt. Just wave your hand or something like that. I'll finish whatever sentence I'm on, however long it is. That gives me an out. I'll address your comments or your question. Does that sound good? All right. Got away with the first slide. 80 to go. I'm just kidding. I actually counted them. There might be more. All right. I'm a philosopher. And I was, until I realized I only had a total of about 2.5 hours, I was going to start off with the meaning of life and the story of the turtle, and I will start with the story of the turtle just because there's a turtle swimming in the ocean, and he's swimming and swimming, and he's under the water, surfaces in the middle of an inner tube. And the turtle looks up and says, "I'm in the middle of an inner tube. Why am I here?" And there is no answer. It could have surfaced anywhere. Now, why did I give you that story? Because it has nothing to do with my talk. It's from Camus or something like that. But it goes to the state of mind I was in when I was trying to put this together. Because when we're talking about quality, which is where I'll start, by the way, when we're talking about quality, we need to talk about what it is that we're up to, what the purpose of all this is, what the meaning of life is. You see how I got to the turtle, right? And I was sitting there thinking, well, where's my starting point this? And I was thinking of nothing but the turtle. And I was getting myself in trouble. But we want to look at what the objectives of e-learning are. Well, indeed, as it turns out, what the objectives of learning are in general. And I thought about that for a little while. Is that my props here? Yep, good. And really, it depends on who you ask. Let's ask, just for a moment, because we don't, usually. Why are we involved in this learning thing anyways? And I picked three views, just sort of out of the air. I probably could have come up with 7 or 8. One view, and this is the view that's instantiated by the testing mindset. You know, we'll get people to do the high stakes end of the course test. It's the content view. Do they know how to read? Do they know how to write? Do they know the capitals a year? So on and so forth. Then again, we got other views, and this is one of my props. See, I was trying. I haven't. That's not a prop. That's, I don't know. Hang on. Whatever it is, I know I don't want to step on it. I decided to sort of acclimatize myself and settle in. And happily, the Australian gave me an education section. I thought that was very nice of them. I don't know how they knew I was here. And I'm probably not going to find it. There was a thing in this education section yesterday talking about what business expects from the new graduates, from the MBA students. I probably read it, which means I don't really need to be looking for it while I'm standing in front of you here. Pardon?
It's on the front page.
It's on the front page, right? Ah, yes. It's just I had it folded to another page I'm using later, and now, of course, I won't be able to find that one either. Right, the new global business capacities, the knowledge part's fairly straightforward. Macroeconomics, finance, strategy, organizational structure, competitive microeconomics, which is kind of an interesting thing, but I'll leave that aside. Decision sciences, which I was taught when I was in school, was called logic. The interesting things: unyielding integrity, worldly awareness, thrive on change, judgment and intuition, demanding excellence, although it leaves open the object of that sentence, perseverance and tenacity. And I'm old enough to remember, and it wasn't that long ago, actually, when you asked business, what's the product of our education? Are we preparing graduates for life in the workforce? And they said, no, it's too general. There's too much of this fuzzy stuff, like integrity. We want people who are trained for specific jobs. There's a danger in the economic view, and the economic view is, it's very day-to-day, subject to fads and fashions, or as people who are in the field of social networking would say, cascade phenomena. And then there's third, the values view. And this is something that gets talked a lot about but doesn't get talked about because, you know, it's not something that shows up on the test. We have the other image aside from the turtle. You have to picture my mind yesterday preparing for this. Because on the one hand, I have the picture of the turtle. I'm also thinking about who is the kind of person who would do really well on any outcomes-based assessment of their education. Probably a professional degree, doctor, say. Worldly, well-spoken, polite. And I realized that I had just described Hannibal Lecter. There's clearly another component to learning, and it's a component that doesn't necessarily show up on the test. He passed brilliantly. So, okay, now I'm thinking quality, and I've got turtles and Hannibal Lecter, and I know I'm in trouble. Okay, let me tell you where I'm coming from on the issue of quality. And try to get this down to as few points as possible, because when I was reading for this particular talk, I was reading about, you know, try to get things into a certain number of points. And most people like 7 points, right? Because that's what we're told short-term memory can handle, which is why you always get, you know, the 7 principles of this and that and so on. And I only had 2. I feel so substandard. The first is, learning cannot be subsumed to the values of a certain sector in society. I felt that that was important. I'm drawing from Rousseau on that, and in particular some of the writing he does in Social Contract. And the reasoning is fairly straightforward. If learning is designed, operated, carried out, etc., according to the values of a certain sector of society, that sector will turn learning into something that promotes its own self-interest at the expense of the whole. And I will add, at the expense of the learner. So, my view of learning then is fundamentally a social view of learning. It's a social view of learning in the sense that the needs and the priorities of a learning system, any learning system from kindergarten right the way through to doctoral education, need to reflect the interests, the needs, and the values of all of society. But I'm not Rousseau, and I'm not going to pull out of the air this mystical construct called the general will. I will depend on British empiricists to do that for me. The best expression of the social good is through individual good, to pursue one's own good in one's own way. And we see this in utilitarianism, we see this in On Liberty, we see this in a wide variety of places. Now, this is not some kind of magical, the marketplace will solve everything kind of theory. This is simply the statement that there is no good over and above the individual good. Now, I know how that's going to sound tomorrow, and that's not what I mean. We can talk about social goods, right? You build a dam, that's a social good. Is it the act of an individual? Of course not. But it is for the good of particular individuals to meet their needs, their objectives, that we build a dam, or that we construct a school, or that we teach a class in mathematics. That was badly explained, so if you want to pursue that in a question, we can go for that. Another thing I've read is you're not supposed to say about your own talk that it was just bad, but what this amounts to. The evaluation of learning should be on a society-wide basis. I'll talk a wee bit more about that in a little bit, assuming I don't run out of time, because I'm already behind. What I'm after there with that statement is the idea, when we think of the evaluation of learning, we think that we're after something very specific. Can Johnny do trigonometry or calculus? Can Susan name the capitals of all of the states? Or, you know, we can move up through Bloom's taxonomy and talk about, you know, do they make good judgments? Do they apply things in new areas, so on and so forth. But the domain of these sorts of questions is always the domain of the learning that took place. But the evaluation of learning, I'll talk about a little bit more, needs to go beyond that, because it's a hard thing, in my view, for teachers to accept. But learning is a means to an end. It's not the end. It's not what we're up to. The reason why we want, I think, people to get an education is so that they can have a happy life, so that they don't live on welfare, so that they don't commit crimes and go to prison, so that they do neat things with their lives. And so when we're evaluating the impact of learning, we need to be evaluating the ends toward which we have put learning. We should be looking at, did this learning work? Well, what were the crime rates? That kind of question. Should be framed from the point of view of individual aspirations.
And no problem.
I'm not going to find it, though. This occupied, I can't believe it, this occupied me on the entire flight between Toronto and L.A. There's no way. You really miss little yellow sticky pads when you don't have them. In this issue of Harper's, which is, they put the diagram over the date. Something Ember, I guess September, could be November 2004. You never know what magazines these days because, we're getting December stuff already. It's a list of all the people who dropped out from school. Bill Gates, dropout. Steve Jobs, dropout. Practically every entertainer you can name, right? Dropout. In my own case as well. I was introduced as having 2 degrees, BA and an MA in philosophy, both from the University of Calgary. What was very politely left out were the 5 or 6 or whatever years I spent studying a PhD. And you can put my name down beside Bill Gates and Steve Jobs as a dropout. At a certain point, it wasn't relevant anymore. The outcome of an education needs to be framed. The evaluation of an education needs to be framed from the point of view of individual aspirations. My education was not a failure. At least I don't think so. In the sense that I got what I needed out of it. I didn't get a little piece of paper, but I got the learning, I got the experience, I got to do neat activist kind of things, I got to occupy an office, stuff like that. The things that are important, I went to toga parties. There are, people have different objectives and different reasons why they studied, and these are not always the things that are measured for when we're measuring for the effectiveness of learning. And finally, this one I wasn't so sure about, but I put it in the frame here because I had half the screen blank. And I needed something, and I wasn't sure exactly how to frame this. It should be measured in terms of capacities rather than content. This is the more concrete way of saying people should be able to pursue their own good in their own way. And by this what I mean is to the best of their ability, or to maximize the opportunities that are available to a person. And the way opportunities are maximized to a person is to give them more capacity. The buzzword these days is empowerment, right? And it seems to me that the fundamental objective of an education ought to be to empower the person who receives it. Again, we don't see this on the exit test. You just took Math 254. Were you empowered by this? So let's look at evaluating e-learning more specifically. What we're after? We're after two things, I think. I'm not really committed to this slide. I'm sorry about that, but this really is the background. This is my background as a philosopher. I come in here, and I'm pretty sure I've got it, but I'm not necessarily convinced of everything I'm going to say. But I think it's kind of right. We want e-learning to be at least as effective, if not more effective, than traditional learning. And we want it to be at least as efficient, if not more efficient, than traditional learning. This, of course, is a trade-off. And we need to understand that this is a trade-off. If we manage to make it more efficient, even if it's only as effective, that's probably good enough for our purposes. That's why all of those studies, and you've probably seen them, the no significant difference phenomenon studies, e-learning is no better than traditional learning. That's still okay if we've somehow made the process more efficient. Overall in e-learning, thought long and hard about this and came up with 7-8 words. Three major approaches. Test for outcomes, which I'm going to address in a little bit of detail in just a few moments. Identifying best practices, which I realized by the time I got to the end of my slides, I practically ignored throughout this talk, but it'll turn out it's okay. And the third one, which is what I will spend more time on after this break, measuring usage. I want to look at the concept of measuring for results, and it wasn't because I had sort of predicted what the introduction to my talk will be, although I realized that I was in trouble as soon as I heard it. But the idea, and sweeping Canada anyways, and maybe to come to a state capital near you, I don't know. It's certainly in my neck of the woods. There's this thing called the Campbell Collaboration. In Canada, it's being promoted by a guy called Charles Ungerleiter, and it's caught the imagination of various people in the educational infrastructure in my country. It's drawn from the Cochrane Collaboration in Medicine. There's a link there, and I realize I forgot to put them in red, so you can't read it. I don't know why the default for PowerPoint for the color of links is like really light purple on white. I mean, this is one of the things that they didn't think through. However, these slides will be available on my website later today, so you actually will be able to get to this link. The idea here is we're trying to evaluate the quality of learning. The way we're going to do that is to see if people learned anything. And so we will conduct precise and scientifically based experiments on learners. From the field of medicine, basically the idea is you do a double-blind test, right? And you keep your environmental conditions constant. You have a control group, and you have a test group, and you alter one variable, and then you measure the impact of that variable. And then if the learning outcome goes up, you can say then that this variable is responsible for improved learning. And if it doesn't go up, then this variable wasn't responsible for improved learning. I wrote a piece about a year or so ago called, I've forgotten what I called it, Public Policy and Research or something like that. I'll make sure it's on the slide. Basically addressing this particular question. And the way I framed my critique of this is that a method such as this works well for normal science, as defined by Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. But we are living in an age where normal science is something that lasts for about 6 months at best, and then we have another scientific revolution. I've lived through 3 or 4 scientific revolutions in my field since I've been in it, and that's only a few years. It doesn't work really for anything resembling what we call e-learning. And it doesn't work because what we think of as e-learning is something that is changing minute to minute. I've missed a couple of days of reading because I've been on airplanes and things, and I've fallen behind the field in the 3 days that I haven't been reading. It's like that. In normal science, you already understand what you're testing. If you're testing for a disease or something like that, you know how a hypodermic needle works. You know how a beaker works. There's no real mystery here. You know that you've got the appropriate device. You know, nasal spray, sprays into nasals. Works every time. The same thing can't be said for the tools that we're using. Even this thing. Part of normal science for this thing is you turn on the computer, it starts. This is a Dell computer running Windows 2000, and I can tell you from experience, when you turn on the computer, sometimes it starts, sometimes it doesn't. This is not the basis on which to be doing Campbell collaboration methodology. But more importantly, and this is a large part of the talk that I'm doing here, the objectives have shifted. What we're up to has shifted. When we talk about the old student and the new student, if we're doing evaluations of learning where what we think we're teaching is the old student, we're actually teaching the new student, then our evaluations are going to be measuring for the wrong thing. One of the big advantages, in my mind, and this is something that's important to me, of e-learning is the capacity for increased accessibility. Somebody mentioned I'm doing a bunch of talks here in Australia. The places I'll be going are places like Cairns and Darwin and Alice Springs. And if I had more time and more money, I'd be going to places like Catherine and I don't even know the name of Wagga Wagga. It's funny because there's a place in Washington called Walla Walla, and I always want to compare them, but I've never been to either place. I'd be getting even further out into the field because for people who live in these regions, and I grew up in a region like this, you have two choices, right? E-learning or nothing. Right. Now, how do you test for the quality of that? Well, nothing. Well, you didn't learn anything. Is that your baseline? And the interesting thing is when you begin to move beyond the domain, when you're testing for outcomes, sometimes it actually looks like you're losing ground. I worked with Athabasca for many years, and Athabasca has an open admissions policy, which means anybody can get in. And part of my work was, you know, working in northern Alberta, going to various First Nations reservations, and teaching logic to people who did not graduate from high school and achieved this 20 years ago. And the success rate wasn't high. And if you looked at that from a pure outcomes point of view, it looks like it was a miserable failure. But, you know, I look at the three or four people who passed. I look at the ones, you know, the one or two people who passed, got their degree, got a master's, came back, and now are teaching in their community. I think of it as a success. But by any rational manner, any quantitative manner, I should not have been teaching these courses. They were a miserable failure because the grade average dropped like a rock. And it's apocryphal. I don't know how true it is, but I suspect it's very true. In the United States, they have their No Child Left Behind Act. And, of course, one of the major mechanisms for this act is that if you are, quote, a failing school, which means that the marks of your students on high-stakes tests are sufficiently below the average, you will be penalized financially, which seems to me like kicking someone when they're down. But that's the method. So what's happening, apocryphally, anecdotally, although I'm sure it's true, is that schools are increasing their test scores by pushing some people off the boat. The person's not going to make it, they're going to fail, whatever. Well, get them out of the system before they impact school funding. This is the tragedy of outcomes-based testing within a narrow scope or domain. And then finally, a point that I alluded to earlier, I was very much not popular in the seminar in Ottawa when I raised this because they were talking about the Campbell or the Cochrane collaboration in medicine, and they had the audacity to talk about treatments of war wounds, and they said they used the Cochrane collaboration methodology to identify best ways of treating war wounds. Somebody gets shot, do this, it works, do this, it doesn't work, so on and so forth. I said, well, what's the best way to take care of war injuries? Don't have a war. This struck me as a good solution. Yet, it falls beyond the scope of Cochrane collaboration methodology. You cannot test for this. Because how do you set up your double-blind experiment? With control, let's have one warring society, one non-warring society. Poverty, pretty much the same sort of thing. I mean, you know, one of the major outcomes of an education is the empowerment of the individual. There are all kinds of studies showing that a person's lifespan is increased with a higher education. in our country because of the public health care system. There's all kinds of tracking of health, and there's a very clear correlation between educational attainment and health. You wouldn't think so, but there it is. Well, actually, you would think so. There's lots of reasons to think that. All of these things fall outside the range of the Campbell collaboration methodology. So what are we testing for when we're testing for particular outcomes? Put that thread aside. How am I doing on time? 2:10. And when am I supposed to stop? 3. Oh, I got lots of time. You should feel free, again, to stop me and interrupt at any time, because... All right. We're going to end that thread. Hang on to that thread. It's going to come back. I want to move to a new thread. This is the part where I stop talking about quality in e-learning and start talking about the new student. This is the part that I'm more comfortable with, because I'm going to begin this part by establishing a little street cred for myself, because from my point of view, and others may disagree, but from my point of view, I am what they call, Tapscott and others call, the digital native. I grew up, in a fairly traditional sort of household. Didn't have much choice because, it was the 70s. We didn't have the internet and things like that. But my father was what they now call a telephone pioneer. He went around assembling telephones, doing switching, so on and so forth. So there was always technology around my house, and bits of telephones and things like that. I had my own TV when I was very young. But even more importantly, when the first video games came out in the early 70s, Pong, of course, as everyone knows, was the first. I started playing Pong when Pong came out. And I got good at Pong. It was cool. I was better at pinball, which of course predated Pong by many years, but I was good at Pong. And over the years, as these games came out, I played them all. All of them. Galaga, Donkey Kong, which I didn't like because I never understood the name. Space Invaders, so on and so forth. And that progressed from the mid-70s right through to this day. The last thing I did before coming on this trip, and obviously wasn't writing my talk, it was playing Civilization for hours and hours and hours and night. Civ 3, to be precise, for those of you who are keeping track. And I tell people I live on the internet. And I do live on the internet. The first thing I did, I hadn't even slept, but the first thing I did when I got here into Canberra is I went down to Canberra Centre and made sure that I had an internet account through Telstra, because the thought of not having internet for the period of time it would take me to go to a cyber cafe, I wasn't ready for that. So, I'm speaking, at least in my own mind, from the point of view of a digital native. And that, to me, anyways, I'm kind of like talking about my own world when I'm talking about that. And I suspect, I'm just looking around the room trying to spot other people who, well, is this anyone online? Is there wireless here? Internet? No? Oh, that's too bad, because tomorrow I was going to put up the wiki and have people comment while I was doing it. I was thought about doing that today. But okay, end of digression. Some obvious stuff. 600-channel TV universe. This isn't true in my hotel room where there are 10 channels. It's not even true, actually, anywhere, except if you have satellite reception or something. But the reality is, 100 channels is what we have at home. 10,000 station radio universe, give or take thousands. This is including things like webcasting and so on and so forth. 8 billion, and this is the key figure for me, 8 billion plus page internet. The main point here is that the range of choices and the availability of media that we have today has dramatically increased. When I grew up, I never thought I'd be old enough to say, when I grew up, We had two television channels, CBC and CTV, and it was a great day when Global came online. We had a third TV network, although the signal was always bad because we didn't have cable. There was CBC Radio, there was CFRA, which is the Government Employees Radio in Ottawa. I grew up near Ottawa. And then one day CFGO came online with their new in-your-face brand of rock music, because we had a third channel. No internet, of course. We did have books, but they were stored in a library, so I'd have to go across town into the library to get a book. But it was a different environment. This phrase here. I love this phrase. Remember when we would go to the library? We would go to the reading room. Do you still call them TV rooms here? Did you ever? Okay. When I grew up, we had the TV room. And it was, of course, the place where the TV was. And it was a special room. This is also called a living room, which I imagine you do have. But it was the TV room. It was a room specifically designed. I'm sure your TV rooms, your living rooms, are designed this way, right? The main focus is the television, and you have seats around it so that you can watch the TV. These special rooms for media, special places for media. To a digital native, this is an odd thing. Because to somebody who has grown up with cell phones, wireless PDAs, so on and so forth, the media is ubiquitous. I can never pronounce that word. It's ever-present. If I were in this audience, and I've been in many audiences like this, I'd be sitting there going, the content's too slow, the content's too slow, I want wireless. I would sit in the back row because I'm like that, you know. Sit in the back row, I'm thinking, man, the bandwidth is so slow in this talk, I can't stand it, it's too slow. Now, I'm standing up here at the front, I'm the one now doing this to you, and the bandwidth is too slow. So it's odd. I wish I could have, like, you know, CNN up there so you'd have something to watch. I really hate this expression, but it's kind of right. The students today, the saying goes, operate, I actually have references, but there are a couple of slides down. Operate on what's called Twitch speed. I really hate that because it implies, like, you know, you're always reacting instantaneously. I don't think that's quite right, but what they expect, what I expect, is instantaneous access to information. I sit in class like this, I mean, why don't I have internet access so I can read his background and see if the introduction was accurate? And from my perspective, it's odd that I don't. And there must be some reason why I don't, because it only costs like $100 to put a wireless port in the classroom, a hub. I mean, $100 is with rooms worth, what, at least $3,000. There must be money for a wireless hub, so there must be some reason why they don't want me to have the information that I can have to check the accuracy of this talk. What they don't mention in the books is digital natives love conspiracy theories. If you don't believe me, read the blogosphere. You know, piece of paper comes out. It's the Bush memos. And 5 minutes later, they're fake. And the thing is, the people who released the memos didn't see this coming. Instantaneous access to information day or night. It's still a source of mystery to me why the TV channels go off, you know, at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning and don't start up again until 6. I don't understand this. They expect to... Pretend I wrote that in a grammatically correct fashion. They expect to be able to communicate with anyone at any point in time. Now, of course, they don't expect people at the other end of the line to be up 24 hours of the day, although they do expect them to have a communications device close at hand so that if they do need to talk to them, they could get up. And then they wonder why. No, they understand. People need to sleep. I mean, they're not stupid. But they do expect to have that capacity to communicate. And this is the part where I'm not a digital native, because it's very strange. because I grew up, of course, as I said, in the home of a telephone pioneer, and we had telephones all over the place. And, you know, we had extensions before there were extensions. I don't like telephones, and I don't like cell phones. And I don't use telephones or cell phones very much at all. So actually, when you called me to see if I had arrived, it was a stroke of luck that A, the phone rang, because my phones are usually unplugged, and B, I answered it. Although I thought maybe I should, seeing as nobody until that point, nobody in this city knew that I was here. But the stereotypes, you know, people walking around with phones glued to their ears and so on and so forth, hasn't taken hold as much in Canada and the United States as it has taken hold in places like Japan and the Philippines and Europe, where, you know, I haven't been to Japan or the Philippines, but in Europe, everyone's glued to their phones. It's amazing. I forget where I read it, but if you look up on Google, thumb generation, you can distinguish between the digital natives and the older generation by how they use their telephones or their PDAs. And the digital natives dial and type and whatever with their thumbs, as opposed to other people who, you know, you want to dial a phone number. Digital natives don't do that because they'd have to put down their coat. And you know, they text like this. And they ran an article about a month ago about the record speed, and they type, you know, 40, 50 words a minute doing that. And I thought, that's slow. Access is a given. Now, you guys are dealing in traditional educational environments. At any given time in your class, there are people who, like me, are saying, why don't I have wireless? If you have residences, already, again, those of you who've read my newsletter know wireless access, or at the very least Ethernet, in the residences is going to be a norm, should be a norm. Instantaneous random access to everyone and everything. Random access is the important concept here. There were words in this slide, but I deleted them because I didn't think I'd say them. Now here I am saying them. The way we deliver learning, even the way I'm giving this talk, it is sequential, linear, non-random access, right? As anyone who's worked in computers knows, or databases knows, that's the worst way to deliver data because it's slow. And non-random access means getting different bits of data at different times when and where you need them, which is exactly the opposite of how we present learning materials in a classroom environment. In fact, pretty well the opposite of what I'm doing here. I should have put this here. Oh, well, never mind. Access could be a feature of their environment. A lot of the stuff I read raises as a serious question things like, should we allow email in the classrooms because it might detract from the professor and so on. In my mind, the serious sorts of questions we should be asking are things like, have we covered the entire campus with wireless access? Is the wireless access compatible with the wireless access available in the downtown core? If there is no wireless access available in the downtown core, what can we do as an institution to make sure that it happens? Because our students are going to be at the cafes downtown, and if they're at the cafes downtown, we want them to have access to their course materials. These sorts of questions. In a lot of the stuff I've read about this, the catchphrase is instant gratification. Instant gratification has such negative connotations because, you know, you think, you know, like drugs and things like that, you know, they want their gratification now. But that's not really the way somebody with these sort of attitudes would express it. I think the way that they would express it is, there's no good reason not to have access in today's day and age. And so, why are these barriers being put up in front of me? Why does it take 30 minutes to register online when really they already have all of my information? Things like that. If you have to go someplace to get information, it's an odd thing to go someplace to get information. And it seems like an imposition that is being put between myself and the information I want. And from the point of view of somebody who was raised in a culture where information is always available, this seems odd, unusual, strange. And consequently, and I've seen this remark, the university structure, the school structure that we see is odd, unusual, and strange to somebody who's grown up in an information culture. Sort of ending that thread, moving into a new thread, although I didn't give it a number. I don't know why. Because we're talking about quality. Let's talk about what we're actually measuring. When we're thinking about somebody who has grown up as what they call a digital native, and I can see by the expressions you guys are already reading this, nobody waits. Why? Why don't you wait till I say it before you read it? 10,000 hours playing video games, that's low. 20,000 hours watching TV, that's probably high these days because the internet is taking over. And TV viewership, at least in my neck of the woods, is going down. 20,000 hours talking on the phone, I can't conceive of that because I hate telephones. But I can imagine some people, like, people drive, and, you know, phone in one hand, coffee cup in the other hand, they're reading. This is why I take public transportation. Countless hours listening to music, surfing the web, using instant messenger, chat rooms, email. Let's see who I'm talking to. How many of you have listened to music online? Now, that's not bad. How many of you had Napster? Okay, a few people willing to admit their gross and flagrant violation of the law. Okay, I assume you all surf the web. Let me ask you a tougher question. How many of you have used a random page access feature of any sort surfing the web? Few? One guy came back, keeps putting up his hands. I know who I'm talking to up there. People say digital natives are defined by age. That is not true. It's so totally not true. What was that? Oh, yeah. How many people use an instant messenger, like ICQ or... I forget what the others are. Cause, yeah. Wow. Okay, here's your takeaway. When you go back, download and install and use at least one instant messaging program. I will recommend ICQ. Why do I recommend ICQ? It's because that's what I use. And the only way you can test this, because you don't know anybody who's using these things, is to send me an ICQ message. My ICQ number is, you notice I know it, 128-7181. I hope those who know ICQ will appreciate what a small ICQ number that is. Your ICQ number will be in the 20 millions or so by now. I think they might be up to 30 million in that range. Your students are using instant messaging. They use it a lot. They use it because instant messaging on the web is part and parcel of the same system as SMS on their telephone. You send SMS messages to ICQ, ICQ to SMS, so that way, even if you don't have your phone, if you have internet access, you're still connected to your friends, which, of course, is what they expect. Chat rooms. How many of you have used chat rooms of any sort? Yeah, more. I figured that. Chat rooms have been around forever. I won't ask you about email. You wouldn't be here if you didn't use email. There's more things I can ask, but I won't. Pardon? How many of you have a mobile phone? Yeah. I'm surprised there are some who don't or just didn't put up their hand. How many of you use the text messaging features on your phone? Okay, that's a lot more than in Canada. In Canada, we'd get maybe 5% of the room using text messaging. Pardon? That's good, yeah. How many of you use your thumbs when you text message? Yeah, now, okay, now, and it's interesting, it's the same people that I was keying on who were doing various knowing smiles at various points in the talk. It's interesting. Pick them out a mile away, I tell you. Yes?
You made this point just before that the digital naming is not an age issue.
Right.
Do you have any idea how it is defined other than by age? Except that they're out there using it.
Well, there. I have a slide later on that says meaning is use. It's in a totally different context and not at all relevant to your question, but that's pretty much the answer. But no, I hate definitions. I'm a Wittgensteinian at heart, which means if you push me for a definition, I'll say, well, it's kind of like... I'm going to talk a little bit, depending on how my time goes, because I'm going to have to rush through some slides. Pretend I didn't say that. I'm thinking just the right way to answer this, because part of what I want to say is that the difference between an old generation and a digital native isn't just one of attitude, isn't just one of use. It is argued, and I agree with this argument, that there are differences in neurological structure, that digital natives see the world in a different way. They think about the world in a different way. I do have slides on that. And I'll talk a bit about that. And the way to approach the answer to your question is to approach it from the point of view of language. You might think that odd, but I'm predicting some slides, but that's okay. I'd rather answer your question off the cuff like this because it's probably better. If a person thinks in words, they're old school. If they're text-based. Right? Now, that there's a whole bunch of associations that come along with that, right? If they're linear, if they believe in structure, if they set out processes. Even military college, I should be careful about this. So on and so forth. They're pre-digital. The post-digital, I argue, and I want to be really, really careful to emphasize that, you know, this is not something that I have, you know, cold, hard, empirical proof for. But I'm pretty sure it's true. Think not so much in words, although words are certainly part of their mental picture, otherwise they would be completely unable to communicate. Some argue that that's the case now, but I'll leave that aside. But the concepts, the way they think about things is a combination, an amalgam of words and pictures and sounds. I have a slide, a few slides down, titled The MTV Generation. Do you get MTV here? Well, we don't get MTV in Canada. We have Made in Canada broadcasting policy, so we get a thing called Much Music. It's just like MTV, but it's Made in Canada. Our country music channel is like that too. We have our news channel is like that too. It's Canadian content policy. I recommend it, actually.
Question? In the quality of this material, to what extent is it frivolous, redundant, low value? Does it mean that the more the numbers, the better you are?
Okay. The question is, if we're talking about quality, how can we talk about, or can we talk about, the quality of these numbers on this slide, the video games, the watching TV, and so on and so forth? And of course, something like television was famously described as the vast wasteland. But for a vast wasteland, it sure takes up an awful lot of time, and that should tell us something. I will address that question. because I think we can look at the quality, but I don't think that the answer will be quite what you were expecting, because television will still be television after I'm done, and it'll still be bad in certain measures, but we need to take a wider view of what television is. And you know, there is a way that you can say a program like Gilligan's Island was good. It is possible. Did you get Gilligan's Island?
Good.
I figured that would, sitting here trying to pick an example of a really bad sitcom, I thought, Island in the South Pacific, I got it.
Do you think, why you got it?
Yeah, okay, sure.
Do you think...
No reading.
Or people who are young enough who have grown up with digital technology, do you think that digital natives, if you describe yourself as what I see as someone who's very excited by digital technology, whereas the people I see of the younger generation who grow up with it are intolerant of it, they expect it, but they are not excited by it.
Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it?
They might say, yeah, let's have wireless, but they might call it a state. Who cares? Is it going to be good for me or not? I don't really care.
Yeah.
For
the microphone, just in case you didn't hear, digital natives, the suggestion is, speaking to the microphone in front of a room of people, would the digital native be excited about new technology the way I am? And of course, no. Apocryphal story. Star Trek, of course, was filmed right in the middle of videoed, I guess, right in the middle of a very influential time for me, which was the mid-70s. Everything good happened then. As Homer Simpson said, music stopped then, 1974 or something like that. That's the other image I had, along with the turtle and Hannibal Lecter, was the moon landing. Because that's one of the most vivid digital images I have. Just because part of the talk is, you know, instant access to information. I sat there and watched the moon landing in Shirley Dowser's living room. And I remember that. And that was instantaneous access to information. Nobody saw a video of Columbus landing. If they had, they would have realized, I have wrong continent. Star Trek, if you look at the original Star Trek series, you'll see this. First year, they have all these switches and dials and so on and so forth. Of course, they do nothing. It's a TV set, right? But still, the actors have to interact with them. You know, they're sort of... Right? And by the third season, right, they just treat them with total disdain. And in the 3 years, even, they became completely used to the set. It just became part of the background. That's a really important point. For the digital native, the technology is part of the background, part of the landscape. I'm still excited by it. And in that way, I'm not a true digital native, because I remember, you know, not having internet access. I hated it. I didn't even know what it was. I knew I wanted it. Yeah. But I mean, but actually, my first experience with something like the internet came in 1980. I worked with this, that wasn't in the intro. I worked with a company called Texas Instruments, which you may have heard of. And part of my responsibility for that was running a system they called Remote Job Entry. Remote Job Entry was a network that connected the Texas Instruments geophysical processing units around the world, in the North Sea, Hibernia in Canada. Beaufort Sea, Texas, of course, and there was a unit in Perth as well, and digital native in training, right? We have this multi-million dollar, you know, state-of-the-art network, and we played chess on it. And the internet, nothing changed. I think there is a sense in which I understand, in a way that digital natives don't, just how much of a change this new technology has brought to us. And that's, yeah, I am excited by it. And that's part of, you know, that's something I won't give up. Good question. Yeah. I thought I'd throw this slide in. You know, it really doesn't really go in, but... this is from, again, there are some references coming later. This is from, I forget the name. Today's kids' values, and this is the phrase, today's kids' values, and I want to say today's kids' learning as well, right? Are not and will not be inculcated by the family, the church, or other institutions in either the present or the future. They are and will continue to be developed by the electronic and visual media. This is where they will learn many of their social skills. This is also where they will learn things like the capital of Afghanistan, which everyone knows now. As they become increasingly immersed in the new digital landscape. The point that I'm trying to draw out with this phrase, or with this paragraph, is that what we're up to in learning is really a very small part of a student's digital landscape. And we need to take that into account when we're thinking about what it is we're measuring when we're measuring the quality of learning. Because what we're probably measuring has very little to do with the input that we think we've created. If we ask somebody on a test, what is the capital of Afghanistan, the odds are as good that they found that piece of information out from CNN or from some song that they listened to, as well as in your class. And you sort of wonder, is that, yes?
Can I just make a point? I'm going to look at that slide. I think of a situation I encountered some years ago, and I don't do much tutoring, but this guy was a student in the class and I'd never seen him. And he didn't do any assignments, so I asked him to come into my office. And he sat down and he couldn't get a word out in about 10 minutes. He went, and he had a bad start. But halfway in the conversation, he said the word computer. So I thought that he had some potential. And then, after a while, I got the sense that he was a pure digital native.
Uh-huh.
He started at 12 and went through the night. But he was going to become a teacher. And I said, basically, I think you're in the wrong game. Really, he couldn't communicate, and he couldn't go into the schools and sort of get any sort of law and order. And what you seem to be saying is that there's a bit of a mismatch between what the sort of world students or young people are living in and the world of traditional education and the values that we stand for. Now, I'm quite unashamedly, I've identified the world of the process, but I'm prepared to concede that there are problems. Like that Australian thing yesterday with the MBAs, I noticed one of the main things was unyielding integrity.
Right.
Because that's one of the main things they're looking for in business people. Now, I'd love to see how we learn things with that.
With unyielding integrity? I think of what the blogosphere would do with that when they see businesses saying that we need people with unyielding integrity, and the blogosphere would say, well, why? I don't want to be dismissive, because I understand the point that you're making. I think integrity is an important value, and I think that digital natives think that integrity is an important value. I think unyielding integrity, I think unyielding anything is a bad plan. And I think, and I'm speculating here, but I think it's a good speculation. I think that a digital native also would say being unyielding is a bad idea. It's bad programming, right? You have to design for various conditions. I think that if we talked about it, what you talk about as integrity and what I talk about as integrity might be different things. I don't know, because of course we're not really in a position to have a discussion on ethics and integrity. But certainly, and this is a cynicism, maybe it's a digital generation cynicism, maybe it's a Gen X cynicism, I don't know. Certainly, you know, there's a lot of talk from the business community about the need for integrity. There's a lot of talk from a lot of people about the need for integrity, but we don't see a lot of it. And it's the very people who call for stuff like this who are now serving jail terms for breach of trust and misrepresenting or misinforming shareholders and things like that. This is a good place to put in a plug for something called the Clue Train Manifesto. badly named. I really hate the name. The idea is, get on the Clue train, get a Clue. Hate the name. But they talk about what might be called digital, integrity from the point of view of digital natives. And they begin with the idea, the very first premise in this manifesto, markets are conversations. And it's the idea of the communication going back and forth and the openness and the honesty. These are things that I don't necessarily see in the old tradition. And these are the points on issues like this, he says, trying to dig himself out, where there are going to be conflicts between what I'm calling digital natives, what other people call digital natives, and the established order. The idea that there is one way of looking at things, the idea that there is one set of values, one tradition. My view, because I talk with and work with people from all around the world, that can't be true. It cannot be true. Because if something like that is true, then 90% of the people on any issue in the world are wrong. Because there are that many points of view. And my feeling is, and I express this in various papers, the only way of getting along in a digital culture is through a recognition that there are multiple value systems, multiple systems of ethics, multiple sets of objectives. That's why I phrased the first slide, pursuing one's own good in one's own way. What counts as good, even, varies from person to person. I'm not sure if I'm responding to your point head on, and you're telling me that you're not agreeing with me, and that's cool. But I hope that sort of went partway through answering your question.
Well, I haven't got any answers to it, but it's really interesting that hardly any Australians can name one politician they trust, you know. And it makes you think about it.
Yeah, same in Canada. And all kinds of surveys. You know, nobody trusts politicians. You know, pillars of our society. And I could name various other professions which... You know, when I grew up, you know, they said, you know, you see this person, and this person. These are the paragons of virtue in our community. And in my community, all three of them did jail time. You know.
So the point is it any worse now that people look to TV and media?
I don't think so. I think we're getting some expected. This wasn't going to be in a slide, and I wasn't sure I wanted to say it, but we're having a conservative wave. Go through Canada, the United States, obviously Australia, it seems to me. And to me, this is an expected and not surprising phenomenon, given that the people who are shaping these opinions now and are instantiating these opinions grew up in a time when all they saw was television. And television, to a large degree, inculcated, you know, fairly conservative values. You know, came from, you know, corporations whose job it was to promote conservative values, and I could go on about that, but I won't. So, the main thing about this conservative wave is it was natural and expected. The other thing is it will end. And it will end because the media picture has been shattered. There is no single message coming to people anymore. There are people who are trying to make it that way, flooding the blogosphere with blogs and things like that. But really, there isn't going to be a predominant ethos anymore. It's not going to be the case. And I think we're already beginning to see the first signs of that. Environics, which is a survey company in Canada, did a survey, and they found that they actually had to divide the population into three groups. The 50 or above, which basically was a mixture of old-time liberal and old-time conservative, which is the structure of our political parties mostly. The middle group, which kind of includes the baby boomers, which is old-time conservative, old-time liberal, and then, you know, Shirley MacLaine. The new age type of thing, which has kind of died out. And then the third generation, which is, you know, everybody up to 25, they had five separate groups. going from everything from punk, you know, what's in it for me, and Rand kind of thing, all the way through to communitarian activist involved and so on. The political lines, the political cleavages, the things that people think are issues, even in the younger set, are completely different from in the older set. It's a completely different political landscape under the age of 25. Conservatism will disappear. Not all of it. Elements will be there. Liberalism will disappear. And we're going to get a much more varied political, moral, ethical, cultural landscape than we had now. You know, like you go into a school, you know, you got the punks, you got the goths, you got the jocks, and so on. Think of that, except replicated on a cultural wide scale. It really changes what we expect. Now imagine these people running the country. And that's what they are going to be doing at some point. I thought I would be running the country one day. It never happened. But anything else on this? Or how am I doing on time? I don't know if it is, but when I was setting up these slides, I have a little slide that says intermission. I looked at it and thought, maybe I should make it later. Yeah. Let's see how far away it is. Oops. No, this is a sneak preview. Woo-hoo. Oh yeah, I got a whole section there. Yeah. Let's take our break now. I have 11 sections and we've done 3. But that's okay because we've actually covered quite a bit of material from the other sections already. I do hope this has been interesting so far. If it hasn't, tell me. If it hasn't, this was nice meeting you. tell them when we're getting back.
I just have a couple minutes after sort of thing. So we'll take about a 20-minute break. Take a few facilities. It's down the corridor through the glass doors.